History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And if you're a longtime listener to this program, you know they don't have to go untold if we're willing to do something about it. Ask a few questions, take a little time to listen. And isn't it amazing how much perspective we gain? Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but we really do become inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. You may have seen a headline or a blurb on the news this week about the 80th anniversary of the Battle of Iwo Jima. It was February 19th, 1945 that the battle began, and it was 80 years ago this weekend that perhaps the most famous photograph of all time was snapped by Joe Rosenthal atop Mount Suribachi on February 23rd, 1945, an image that is captured in larger-than-life 3D form at the Marine Corps War Memorial at Arlington National Cemetery. But the Battle of Iwo Jima would continue on for 5 weeks at the cost of more than 6,800 American lives. Another 19,000 were wounded. Over the years on Hometown Heroes, we've heard from men who were involved in the battle for Iwo Jima as part of the Navy, the Army Air Corps, even the Coast Guard, which helped deliver Marines to those volcanic shores. But today's episode will feature the memories of three Marines who each contributed to that total of more than 26,000 Purple Hearts awarded in just 5 weeks. Think about how staggering that really is, all to get the two airfields on that tiny Pacific outpost. Airfields that would become strategically important for the Allies in the final months of World War II. And consider this, many of those Purple Heart recipients had already been wounded in previous battles. That was the case for a teenage Marine named Max Roof, who had earned his first Purple Heart on Saipan less than a year earlier.
This one time that I remember, I got off the beach and there were just bombs were going like mad, shells were and so forth, and I spotted this little hole over here, kind of a cave-like. I said, well, let me get in that, to get out of this mess for a minute, you know. And so I got in there and it was all dark and I couldn't see, but finally I could see what was in there was shells and bombs and so forth, to be picked up somewhere along the way by the Japanese themselves. It was their own weapons. And so I said, I'm going to get out of here, because they were showing, they were just a mess. So I got out of that deal, and I found out later that it hit and really exploded. Unfortunately, most of our, well, about the 30 or 40 people that I was involved with, in it and out of it, so to speak, about half of them made it. I was one of them that did make it. Mostly. I mean, I was
Well, that's debatable. We have to hear that story. From the time that you hit the beach to the time that you were wounded on Iwo Jima, how much time passed there? How early on in the battle were you hit?
It was way back into the middle almost. I wasn't hit on the beach itself. I got hit further back in when they finally got a whole bunch of Japanese armor and actually men came through and was hitting a bunch of us that got hit bad, and they did it, and that was what they're there for. But I was able to at least get back alive.
Well, I want to ask you more about that and get all the details, but between the time that you got there and the time you were wounded, there was a lot happening on this island, and of course, the most famous thing that happened on that island is something that you were there for. The flag went up. Well, it went up twice. Two different flags went up atop Mount Suribachi. What do you remember seeing and hearing, and what did it mean to you?
Well, I was in front. I never forget it. That one time, with a lot of explosion going on, and also, and I was kind of digging in along with about 10 other guys that were trying to get underneath it a little bit. So I did look back this one time and seen that we were kind of taking it over, but I was moving forward and to fight the Japanese out there that were still there. But it was, in a sense, kind of exciting to be there and see that we're taking things over, at least physically, and I hope mentally as well.
But there's no time to cheer when somebody's shooting at you.
No, it wasn't. It was either die or not die. You had no choice. But that was okay. We made it out. And several thousand, I said earlier, that was killed in Evo. I wasn't one of them. I had eventually four back operations, hip replacement, and a lot of internal injuries and so forth. But I came out fairly good.
I want to hear the rest of this story, but I do want to ask you one more thing about Mount Suribachi and that indelible image, that Rosenthal photo of the group hoisting that flag. That photo is on the back of your business card. When you look at that photo now, when you look at the Marine Corps statue at Arlington National Cemetery there that honors those men and everyone who fought there, what do you think of when you see that image?
One thing, I feel proud. I really do. And I'm so proud that I went into the Marines. You knew I got banged up pretty bad, but to me, I was proud, and I still am.
Well, let's talk about this injury, because I know we've alluded to it a few times, but if you can, share with our listeners the details of what happened to you, what you were doing, where you got hit, what it felt like. Walk me through that, if you can. What were you doing at that time?
I was fighting with a rifle, guys coming in like mad. Marines and fighting Marines, I should say, but guys that were the Japanese, but also more Marines were coming in trying to protect. Everybody was there too. When I got hit, the first time I got hit, or on Net Island, I almost mentally lost it. I just knew that I was hurt bad, but I kept kind of fighting, but not really. I kind of figured out what do I do next? Where do I go? And how do I get out of here? But I couldn't and didn't until they picked me up in a blanket and got me out.
So it was shrapnel from a landmine and fragments of a hand grenade that got you at the same time?
Mostly hand grenades that got hit me badly.
Where did it get you?
Pretty much all over in my body and so forth. But again, I got out. I went immediately to the hospital, shipped out to the hospital. Then immediately flew me on to Guam. And I was in Guam Hospital for several months and before I got back to Hawaii. And then they shipped me on then to San Francisco and then home.
Well, I'm sorry for all these questions about the same thing. But when you say that it took you several months to recover, I think we can all tell these were pretty serious injuries. And this hit your front, not your back? I mean, did you get it in the face, the shoulders? Where did it all go?
I can't answer that intelligently. I was bleeding all over. I got hit on the back very seriously, and that's where I had four back operations.
I know that when there's an explosion, when there's shrapnel, sometimes you can be blinded temporarily.
That was exactly correct. I did go blind, as a matter of fact, as the operator on my eyes when they flew me to Guam, and I was I couldn't see for about 2 weeks, and then they operated on three different times, the doctor told me later. So eyes was a bad thing in my face and so forth, but you wouldn't take anything very large to knock your eye out, you know. So.
Did you lose consciousness? Were you aware of what was going on, or were you completely out of it?
I would have to say I was aware of it. I wasn't completely out of it. I was hurting pretty bad. I wasn't crying like some of them were, and I wasn't. Didn't mean that's bad. It just hurting, but I made it through.
Obviously, you couldn't evacuate yourself. You had to wait for a corpsman to come help you?
I had to wait for almost an hour for some. They were picking other people up as well. And I was in the group where, for a lot of them were dead completely in the same area. And the two guys would pick us up, take us on over to the next little spot, and then somebody else would take over, and then they would come back and try to get somebody else.
The battle's still raging on. It's not like they say, time out, we need to get some guys out of here. Yeah. You have to wait for the guys that are actually walking to get you out. That seems like a very helpless situation to me when you know you're hurt. You know you're bleeding, you can't move yourself, you're waiting for an hour. What kept you focused on surviving in that hour? That's probably one of the longest hours of your life, I would imagine.
It was pretty severe, I'll have to admit that. They couldn't get to me, you know, but it was hurting so bad that I'm not even sure I was going to make it, frankly.
When you're in a situation like that with so many casualties as there were on that island in particular, sometimes stretchers can be in high demand, and they're not always there when you need them. So they didn't have a stretcher to carry you out, and they actually put you in a body bag?
A body bag's what it was, and there were too many guys having need to help, you know. So I don't even see a stretcher now. Looking back, all I seen was body bags, guys picking up, getting guys picking up in bag bags. There'd be two guys one in front and one back, and they'd get us in and go.
You're not completely there in a situation like that when you're so severely wounded, but if you are starting to think you're not going to make it, then putting you in a body bag doesn't encourage you very much, I wouldn't imagine.
Didn't make it. I didn't even think about it. No, it didn't even dawn on me that I should be on something else. Where's my stretcher? Where's my stretcher? It didn't even occur to me.
So they took you to Guam, and you said months of recovery. It seems like that would be a challenging time to you, too. What do you remember about that time period and the challenges that you faced just to be able to function again?
Yeah, that was tough. I have to admit that because I really was hurting all over, not just my eyes, but my whole body. For a long, long time, I couldn't walk, it was miserable, I got to say that. And then when I couldn't talk either, I'm not talking very good now, I admit that. But then I was really, I stuttered just 100% almost. You couldn't even understand me. And why I could go out and start my own business to talk to people on how to do this, and talk about even whitewashing, you know, because I got it done. And I got the jobs that I wanted. The timing was right. It wasn't that I was that good, but it was just timing was good, and they needed the job done, and nobody else was doing it, so okay, give them a try, you know.
I know it's been a long time since then, but when you think back of that time after you were injured, the long recovery, and then trying to get yourself back into life, was there one thing that really motivated you or picked you up or kept you moving forward?
Sure was. One thing. And this sounds kind of goofy, but I did not want to be poor. That was the big thing. As I mentioned to you, my folks were just lovely, lovely, lovely. But because they lost all their money in back in the 30s in the Depression, and then they never recovered, really. And so I never experienced anything except I just didn't want to be just poor. I just had to make that was the main thing that made me go forward, and I have to say, be successful, and we were. And with six children and a beautiful wife, I was successful all over. And I thank God, generally at least once a week, sometimes often than that, for what he's given me.
The late Max Roof, a Purple Heart Marine from Iwo Jima. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, another teenager whose life would be forever changed by his experiences 80 years ago on that island. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode dedicated to the 80th anniversary of the Battle of Iwo Jima, where the famous flag raising atop Mount Suribachi, both the first flag and the second flag, search that online if you want to explore the whole backstory on that, took place February 23rd, 1945. Carl Appel was a 19-year-old Marine who didn't make the initial landing, but would soon be called upon because of the extreme casualties on Iwo.
Well, we were, floating reserve, and at night we'd pull away from the island, and then in the mornings we'd pull back in close enough that we could see the shore, and we could see planes diving down and little dots running around on the island. It appeared that we were, you know, inflicting quite a bit of damage, but then word came through the onboard speakers that we were going to be called in because of the terrible casualties that the Marines were taking at that time. So we boarded the landing craft, and the balance of the 3rd Division landed on D+5.
Well, and as you describe being in floating reserve and being able to see what's happening, you know, the question that comes to my mind, and probably a lot of people listening, is did you see that one thing that so many people have seen since, because it's probably the most famous photograph of all time, the Marines lifting the flag atop Mount Suribachi, the second flag, there had been a smaller one put up earlier. Did you happen to see a Stars and Stripes flying atop the mountain?
Yeah, we saw the flag. We didn't actually see the raising of the flag, but we did see it when it was up there. That certainly lifted our spirits a great deal.
Was that misleading at all? Did it make you think that your side had made more progress than they really had?
Well, not necessarily. We knew that Suribachi was a real difficult thing to take, and that flag, when they put it up, they were still receiving fire from the Japanese, and caves and so forth were still entrenched in the Mount Suribachi.
So you see that from the ship, then they've got you 5 days after the initial landing, they have you on this landing craft going into the shore. So why don't we pick up the story there? What was that teenage Marine seeing, hearing, experiencing from that point on?
Well, when we were going in, they held us off for a while for some reason. I guess the shore, landing shore or beaches, were so jammed with destroyed vehicles and landing craft that they had to clear enough space for us to get in. And when we went in, of course, they dropped the ramp and we went ashore. And of course, there's a series of terraces from the beach up to the main part of the island. And I'm sure most of you can relate to running in sand. You take one step forward and you go slide back too. So it's quite a challenge to get up to a place where we're on the level and could get into some cover. We progressed up to airfield number 1, where we dug in for the night. And during the night, we received some artillery shells in and around the airfield there. Fortunately, I was able to get into a foxhole that had already been dug, thanks to another Marine somewhere. And so I got in that foxhole and put my poncho over me. Then, of course, we'd get these shells in here. Unfortunately, none landed in my hole.
Did they land in some other people's holes?
Not to my knowledge. I did hear that there were some casualties, but I didn't see it or witness it at all. And the following morning, we moved up to a position of what they called immediate reserve, just behind the main line. When moving up, I saw my first dead Marine. I remember observing him, and apparently he had been standing on the edge of a foxhole, or shell hole, I should say. And when he was hit, he just fell straight back. I remember looking at his lacings on his leggings and just thinking to myself that when you lace those, you didn't think that you were going to end up like this. And in looking at him a little closer, he had been hit directly in the head and clenched in his fingers of his right hand was the stub of a cigarette. And apparently he had been standing up next to that hole smoking, and Japanese aimed at that cigarette glow and hit him right in the head.
That's got to get your attention and make you wonder what's going to happen to you.
Yes, yes it did. And they say there's no atheists in foxholes, and I certainly agree with that, because I did an awful lot of praying.
I believe it. Did you do much sleeping at all? I mean, you talk about that first night and then a second night. I mean, was it difficult to actually close your eyes and sleep?
Yes, I don't think that I really got a good sleep at all, because of the worry that you had and the shelling. It just wasn't conducive to sleeping. Actually, the second day, we'd moved up to airfield number 2, going to spend the night at that position, and then the following day, go into an attack to try to take El Peter, which is north of the airfield. I was buddied up with one of our squad members, Joseph Bandiera. We started digging a foxhole or a hole so that we could get in. You know what it is like trying to dig a hole in sand? It just keeps sliding in. I had was assigned what they call a pick-matic, which was like a pick on one side and another blade on the other side of it, and that didn't work worth a darn in sand. And below us, there were two dead Marines, and they had been digging in to make a foxhole. They didn't have helmets. I don't know what happened to them, whether the Japanese got them or what, but they're bareheaded, and the one had a shovel, so I had that pick-matic. Well, that wasn't doing any good, so I went down, and I got the shovel from the one Marine there that was dead, so that worked quite a bit better to get our hole dug. And about the time that we got it deep enough for Bandiera and I to get into, there was a stretcher party that came down over the bank, and we, of course, helped them get down. And when they got through, traveling through our area, they had caved in all of our hard work. We didn't have any coverage. And just shortly after the stretcher party went through, we got some mortar shells in, or artillery shells. And, of course, we both dived for the hole. Well, I was a little slower than Bandiera, and I ended up on top of him in this hole, and it wasn't quite deep enough because my buttocks was above ground level. Well, we got these artillery shells, and a piece of shrapnel hit me in the buttocks, and it stung, but it didn't break the skin. It just hit flat, I guess. So after that shelling, we started digging again, and we finally got the hole deep enough for both of us. After we'd gotten in the hole, and of course it had turned dark, and they were sending up star flares that would float down. And as they floated down, they would, of course, oscillate, and the light hit these two Marines, dead Marines, in the hole below us. And the way the flare was going back and forth, it caused shadows on the guys' heads, and it made it look like they were moving, and that was really a scary thing.
Well, the whole thing sounds like a scary thing, and I don't want to lose sight of the fact that you're still a very young man. What were you, 19 years old?
Well, I was at that time, yeah, about 18, 19.
And what was your realistic expectation in facing all of that, even just in 2 days that you've described for us of combat on Iwo Jima? Did you really think you were going to make it out of there alive?
Well, of course, hope springs eternal, and I was certainly hoping so. And after seeing so many casualties, it certainly put some doubt in your mind. Anyway, the following morning, we went into the attack to take this high ground. And, of course, the Japanese were firing down on us from this elevation, and we had to cross this open area. I saw Westberg, who was in our squad. I saw him get hit and his ammo cans fly. And shortly after that, I was just about to dive in a hole, and when I was hit, the bullet, the angle was I was running in, and the angle that the Japanese were shooting at us, the bullet came right down by my head and right down along the inside of my leg, not penetrating, but just grazing me. And then it hit in my next to my heel and then in my ankle and just went on and into the ground. So it was just one of those what we term $1 million wounds. It wasn't serious enough, but it was serious enough that it got me out of combat.
Yeah, it didn't threaten your life necessarily, but it made it so you couldn't fight anymore.
Yeah, and had I been just a few inches to my left, it would have hit me right in the head. But fortunately, it you know, I was in that angle where it didn't hit me directly.
Well, and it sounds like that the angle that they were shooting at you from was pretty much right on top of you, so your head was the biggest target.
Well, I have a big head anyway.
What did that feel like? Were you in pain?
Actually, it felt like I'd been hit with a baseball bat. When I landed in the hole, I landed on top of my left foot, and of course it was all numb, and I was a little leery of looking at it, but I moved it out from under me, and I could see that, you know, it was a grazing wound. So I, of course, all carried a little first aid packet with a compress in there and some sulfa powder, and so I applied that to the wound. The Japanese, he was still firing at me even though I was in that hole. So I realized that this compress that I'd used was white and showed up quite nicely, you know, for a target. So I had a mosquito head net, camouflage mosquito head net, in my pack. So I took that out and wrapped that around the white bandage so that it blended in a lot better. Corman came up and checked me, and he said, well, you've done everything I can do for you. He said, I'll write your tag out and tag you. We have more serious to the wounded up in front, so you'll have to make your way back to an aid station. So I would get up, and I'd run a little bit, and the Jap would fire at me, and I'd throw myself on the ground and roll, and anyway, I finally worked my way back to a point where I was out of the range of the Japanese that was firing at me. I hobbled as best I could over somebody who was in our squad who had seen me going back, said they never saw anyone run so fast in one leg in their life. Anyway, I got back to the point where there were some walking wounded that were heading to the aid station, and they assisted me in getting down to the aid station where a surgeon or the doctor there checked me out. I waited there until they called them ducts. They're amphibious vehicles that they had, and so they loaded me on one of those with several other wounded. And I remember one of the corpsmen, he said, this man that's next to you, he told me, hold his hand. He had what we term shell shock. He would, least bit of noise, and he would shake. But when you held his hand, it gave him a sense of security, even though he was out of it, so to speak. Anyway, we went out to what had been a troop transport, but they converted it to a hospital ship. So they hauled me up on a crane on the stretcher, and then they took me down into the aid station in there. And as I was lying on the stretcher, I heard someone say, hey, Carl, and here it's Westwood, who I'd seen get hit earlier. He was waiting to go in to have the wound cleaned and so forth. And so, anyway, that was quite a coincidence to see him there.
Well, I'm just guessing, but I imagine you probably also saw a lot of guys who were in worse shape than you were.
Oh, very much so. Well, there was one young man that had quite a wound in his leg. Another young man had opened his mouth to yell and had a bullet go right through his jaws without injuring anything, without hitting his teeth or anything. So you talk about lucky, he certainly was. It knocked him out, but then he came to and ended up on the same ship that I was for medical aid.
And how long were you on the hospital ship? How long were you in the hospital period? How long was it before you could walk normally again?
Well, the ship that we were on, when it was had its full load, so to speak, we headed back to Guam, and I was in the hospital there for about a month. Then, after being released from the hospital, I went back to my division, and my outfit, who had returned from he was at that time, and I joined my old outfit again, and I developed a coral infection in the scar tissue, the wound on my heel, and as a result of that, it caused what they call a keloid condition, which resulted in me being not combat efficient, so I was then transferred to the personal effects section, and till I had enough points built up to return to the States.
So when I asked you how long it was till you could walk normally again, was that a trick question? Is the answer never? I mean, is this something that has bothered you to some extent ever since?
Well, to a point, I can walk okay, but that, of course, that scar tissue can break open quite easily, even now. In our initial machine gun squad, we had 100% casualty, but no what we term KIAs, or killed in action. Every one of the original squad was wounded, but we didn't lose anyone, which is very unusual.
Very unusual. And how many guys in your squad?
I believe, if I remember correctly, about 7. And like I say, I saw several of them get wounded before I did. And like I say, fortunately, none of us were killed of the original squad.
You went back to Iwo Jima for the 50th anniversary of the battle. So this is 1995 we're talking about. What did you do there? What did you see? And what did it mean to you?
Well, of course, we flew in. They took us by truck to, well, I guess, first of all, to Suribachi. And so we got to get to the top of Suribachi and see the memorial up there. And then later that day, they had a joint service with the Japanese. They had a presentation of flags and so forth, which was quite moving for all of us. Then after that, we continued a little tour of the island. We got to see into some of the caves and enforcement that they had. Then later in the day, they flew us back to Guam. But it was certainly a, how shall I use it, gut-wrenching day, because you remembered all the sad things, and also there were some good things, too, that came to mind.
Well, and I don't know where all you went on your little tour, but did you ever get close enough that you could see the spot where you'd been hit?
No, quite frankly, it. For one thing, over the period of years, the vegetation had grown back, whereas when I was there, everything was just barren. That all the shelling and everything had just knocked everything down. Airfield 1, where we'd gone for the first night, was no longer in existence. But Airfield 2 was. We did drive by it, but I couldn't really determine where it was that I'd been hit on, as far as the location on the field.
You know, I often ask vets if they've been to Washington, D.C. to see the National World War II Memorial. But in your case, I wonder even more, have you been to Washington, D.C. to see the Marine Corps Memorial with that giant statue of the Marines lifting the flag atop Suribachi?
Well, I did see that. I went on that honor flight. We did get to see the flag-raising memorial, but unfortunately, I couldn't get in. They didn't have any facilities for me to get into the Marine base there or the Marine Museum, which I have loved to have seen.
Well, I've got two questions for you on that. At the National World War II Memorial, looking at that wall of gold stars representing 406,000 Americans who died, so many of them your fellow Marines at Iwo Jima, what did you think of when you were looking at that?
Well, it, of course, brought back a lot of memories of the guys I've associated with. I realized what the number of losses that we were, just how serious things were. It was quite an experience to go back to see that.
Was there a thought at all of, if I had been a few inches to the left, I'd be part of one of those stars?
That entered my mind also. You know, But the good Lord had other things for me to do, I guess.
Like share his story with us so we could have a taste of just how great a price was paid 80 years ago this week on Iwo Jima. It's time for our final break, but we'll hear yet another Purple Heart Iwo Jima Marine story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and this special episode in honor of the 80th anniversary of the Battle of Iwo Jima, a costly victory that created more than 6,800 Gold Star families and left 19,000 more Americans with Purple Hearts. A Purple Heart and a Gold Star family would both become part of Jim Friel's life. He would go on to become police chief in Topeka, Kansas, but 80 years ago this week, he was a fairly experienced Marine about to experience things he hadn't dealt with before.
The place had been bombed for 72 consecutive days, and the Air Force had bombed it for 72 consecutive hours. I mean, they'd shelled it for 72 days, Navy. And when we were going in, they were still shelling the island before we landed, and you could see the shells lobbing in there and exploding. So you made you wonder. And they said that the most we could expect was a few days Japanese soldiers. Well, a few that lasted 36 days before we secured the island.
And did anyone say anything to you at all about tunnels?
No, no. There were no tunnels or nothing like that. They didn't know. Their intelligence wasn't as good as they thought it was.
Well,
see, the only thing they had on the island was what they call them, they're swimmers. That went in.
Frogmen,
yeah. That was before SEAL teams.
Well, tell me about that morning, because if I'm doing the math, you're a little more than a week away from your 22nd birthday in February 19th, 1945. How did that day start for you?
Just like any other day. It was no different. You didn't celebrate birthdays when you were in the Marine Corps. That was just another day. First sergeants have a way of not losing track of time. First sergeants do not have a sense of humor. It's all business.
You knew you were going ashore that day.
We were going ashore. And we wanted to go. You know, about time we get to... We hadn't seen any Japanese yet. Well, we were aboard ship, of course, and we got ready to land, so we had to go over the side of the ship, crawl down the cargo nets into the landing craft, wait till they load up one craft, and then they'd join a circle, what they call rendezvous, until they got the whole wave, and then they would just be going in circles. They'd just split out and split off and head for shore in wave. And I was in the second wave on the left flank.
So what did you see as you were approaching the island?
Just smoke, and you could see shells and stuff and see activity, but, you know, you couldn't hear what was going on. And we didn't realize that the lava was going to be so difficult to walk on or crawl on. And it would cut right through your dungarees. It was kind of a shelf there where you had to crawl up. And they couldn't get mechanized equipment later to go on it because, you know, they just bury itself. So they had to get those big sheets of metal, corrugated kind of metal, that they'd lay like they'd put on airfields and stuff.
Yeah.
In order to get their heavy equipment, motorized equipment.
I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes. You're getting closer and closer. You told me smoke. You said the shells are coming over.
You could see the explosion, but you couldn't hear them, of course, from that point.
And are you getting fired upon as you're coming ashore?
No, we were ashore before they opened up from the mountain, and then they
cut loose. But they had them all buried back in tunnels and bunkers and stuff. They had a lot of time to build it and get prepared.
So you come ashore, and what are you supposed to do? Where are you headed?
My unit was supposed to bisect the island and then make a left turn and go up the mountain, take the mountain. And I never made it across the island, much less up the mountain. And I got wounded.
Yeah, tell me what happened.
Well, you know, it's just kind of like a bee sting. You reach up here and a handful of blood. You reach back here, see if you still got a head. It's okay. Corman came by and put a bandage around your neck. Then they made you go back to the aid station, put you by board ship. A sound, but just explosive sounds, like artillery or mortars, a lot of mortar fire. And that's what I got hit by, was mortars, shrapnel.
What were you doing at the time?
But going across the island like I was supposed to. Jumping from, see, you couldn't dig a foxhole. So the only thing you could hide in from or jump in was another shell hole. As soon as you're just trying to advance.
Because if you tried to dig a foxhole, it'd just fill in because of the nature of the sand?
Yeah, it just cover you up.
So you're taking cover in one shell hole after another?
Right, across the island. We were supposed to dissect the island and turn left.
And you said it felt like a bee sting, and this is right on your neck?
I said it went right in here, and it's lodged right in the back here.
So it went right in under your right jaw, and it's lodged on the back left side of your neck.
Never thought about it at the time, but I've been so grateful. I got shot in the front. I didn't get shot in the back. I've thought about that a lot.
It's a matter of pride for a Marine?
Yeah.
But I'm just thinking, if this shrapnel comes through under your chin, through your neck, ends up on the other side of your neck, on the back left side, it had to pass your jugular and your spinal cord and not damage it. And that's probably not easy to do.
Well, I wasn't in charge of the transportation arrangements for the... it took what was given me.
And you've got an X-ray on your wall here in Topeka that shows that shrapnel is still there. How do you explain that wound and how it didn't do more damage, how it didn't kill you or paralyze you or any of that?
By the grace of God. By the grace of God.
And correct me if I'm wrong, in listening to your description here, it sounds like you weren't too worried about how it felt. You were kind of disappointed they made you go to the aid station.
Right. Yeah, because I was still ambulatory. I never was on a stretcher till I went back to the boat, I mean, to the ship. Difference between a boat and a ship. If you don't believe that, try to explain it to a soldier or a sailor.
And a submarine's a boat, I've been informed many times. Did you lose much blood?
I don't remember losing. Of course, it was a handful, but no, I didn't. I didn't require a tourniquet or anything. They're going to put a tourniquet around my neck. They got to fight me.
But there was a corpsman right there with you?
He came up on right quick like. And both of those guys are good. I'll tell you how much we as Marines think of corpsmen. Corpsmen and chaplains are the only ones invited into the Marine Corps League other than Marines.
So they take you to the aid station? Yeah. Then they put you back on the ship. What are you thinking? What's going through your mind?
I want to get doctored up so I can get back to shore, get back and join my unit. Didn't think about leaving or going. I was sat out there in that harbor on that hospital ship 4 days until they put the flag up.
And that flag?
The original one, you know. And then they come back and took the one that newspaper guy.
So there was the first flag, and the admiral on the ship says, that's not big enough, let's put a bigger one. And then the second flag raising is the famous photo that's the statue at the Marine Corps Memorial in Washington, the Rosenthal photo. And in that photo is your friend, Ira Hayes.
That's right.
Why don't you fill in the rest of that story for people who don't know the Ira Hayes story, because I'm sure you followed along.
Well, Ira Hayes was in my unit in the paratroopers, so I knew him when they signed us to the division. He went into Easy Company, and I was sent to Dog Company. So we crossed the parade ground from each other. And that's the last I saw of him until after the war was over.
When did you put it together? Was it looking at the photo or hearing some of the publicity as they sent him around to raise money for war bonds and all that?
Well, he was sent on that bond tour after he and I went on a plane when we come home on Liberty that time. No, I never saw him after that.
And there's been a lot written about him, and movies have been made. And
didn't look anything like Tony Curtis or...
or the guy in Flags of Our Fathers. For people who don't know, tell us what happened to Ira after that, because the sense I think we get is that the celebrity that he became was a burden on him.
It was, and after the war, he was discharged, and he was drowned in 3 inches of water in the gutter in Chicago. And Johnny Cash wrote a song about it, The Ballad of Ira Hayes.
Well, and just thinking about Ira Hayes, right? I mean, there's a cost of war, and sometimes casualties happen in the moment, and sometimes they happen later. And he's another one that I think we can chalk up to the cost of war. But for you, I mean, you're wounded the first day at Iwo Jima. As you said, you're on the ship when the flag goes up. And did you find out about that on the ship?
Yeah, because, the blue horns and all that hoopla. So you inquire what's going on, and that's what you're told. But I was on the hospital ship at that time.
And since then, you've seen that image hundreds of times, maybe thousands of times, the Rosenthal photo or the 3D rendering of it, that's that incredible statue at Arlington.
It's a big thing. You stand alongside that thing, and you have to look up at that.
And if you walk around, it really looks like the flag is moving. It's going up. But when you look at that image, and one of those guys was your friend, what do you think of when you see that photo, that moment frozen in time?
Well, just glad that you're aware of it and acquainted with some of the people in it. Ira was the only one I knew because it was a different company and a different platoon.
But you were supposed to be part of that effort to take Mount Suribachi.
Yeah, if things had worked out, I would have been.
And I don't want to put words in your mouth or thoughts in your head, but here you are turning 100 years old, maybe because you were wounded when you were the way you were. Have you ever thought that wound maybe saved you from something else that could have happened?
Remember the old Tennyson poem, Charge of the Light Brigade? Mm-hmm. Not ours to question or wonder why, only ours to do or die. That's the only thing I've ever thought about. You can't choose your place at times, particularly in the battlefield.
So some guys, have shared with me, they got wounded, it sent them home, it was a $1 million wound, and they were excited to come home. I'm not getting the sense that you were excited to come home.
No, I wanted to be there until the end. Finish the job, never leave any. I was trained or taught when I was in school, never played. Don't do anything you can't finish. Don't leave a job half done.
So tell me about that. They send you home, and you come back here to Topeka, right?
Yeah. Came back and was here on a 30-day leave, including travel time. Mm-hmm. And travel at that time was either by bus or something like that, unless you could afford a plane, and nobody did. You hitchhike across the country. You could go anywhere in uniform in those days.
In fact, I think I read that you hitchhiked to your home, and your mom was a bit surprised.
Oh, absolutely. She almost fainted when I came to the door. But I hitchhiked from Corvallis, Oregon. That's where the hospital was. Spent the night in jail in Steamboat Springs, Colorado. Stopped there. It was snowing, and the old town marshal come by. He says, come on down in the station. We sat there and talked. He had a son in the Marine Corps. We talked till 2 o'clock in the morning. He says, go in there and lay down one of those cells. He said, I won't lock the door.
I'm sure when you said spent the night in jail, people had all kinds of ideas. Oh, yeah. But yeah, so you made it all the way back, and your parents didn't know you were coming.
They had no idea. I used to get aggravated at my mother. She'd call the Red Cross because I hadn't written. Well, the military wouldn't let you tell where you were or what you were doing or anything about the terrain because that would give away your location of your troops. So if you can't write anything, why even write? Although you could write free on the corner and you wouldn't have to buy a stamp. Some things weren't logical to me. Uh-huh. But that's life.
So your mother almost fainted, but I'm sure she was
Relieved to have you home.
The sad part about it, I was home when they got notification that my brother had been killed. You know, it was a shock to her when those two officers came up the sidewalk in uniform, dressed blue uniform, to let her know that her son had been killed.
You were there.
And I was home, which may have been helpful to her. Or maybe she thought like I thought. Why not me? When, you know, I'm oldest. I've been here longer. He's got a lot longer to live than me. So I don't know.
Well, you just partially answered my next question. You said maybe it helped her to have you there, but I'm wondering how this affected you, because this is your brother, 14 months younger, that you grew up with, did everything with. He went in the Marines first. He'd already survived Guadalcanal and Peleliu, and you find out he was killed at Okinawa. How did that affect you?
See, he was involved in the first battle of the war, Guadalcanal. That was our first engagement. And killed on the last battle of the war, Okinawa. So it didn't really seem fair, but then who's to say who's fair?
And did you ever get any details about what happened to him?
He was killed by mortar shrapnel. I think there was along about that same time, one of their generals and a newscaster was killed. Yeah. Remember? Ernie Pyle, on that same action.
And you've had a very productive life since the war, and that's still going. Have you ever contemplated what kinds of things Bill would have done had he survived?
We'd had a good time together. I know that. We had a good time growing up. I have no idea. I don't know what his aspiration would have been.
You can't lose anyone closer to you than your brother. But it also occurs to me, you have a picture on your wall of your unit, your platoon that went ashore at Iwo Jima, and you told me everyone in that photo was either killed or wounded. Are there some other guys that you knew well that you lost in the war that you still think about today? So you're pointing at the wall. You want me to pull this photo down. I'll do that. And for everybody listening, we're going to post this photo on Facebook and at hometownheroesradio.com. So it's got your picture on the back, has the names of everybody. It shows where you are. It says wounded in action or killed in action next to everybody. And there's three that have question marks. Everyone else was either wounded or killed. You're looking at those names right there. Are there some that you still can picture in your mind or think about?
Well, yeah, because, you know, you trained with those guys for several months before you went into action. There's Lieutenant Worry. He's a little old second lieutenant, real nice young kid. And, you know, he's our leader, and he gets killed. So there's no rank, doesn't have any kind of privileges there. And a lot of them I can't recognize anymore. Bob Mueller was my best buddy. I think this is Bob. He died just last year.
Well, and I look at the names here where it says KIA next to him, and I look at another picture you have on your wall, and I've seen this view before. It says 5th Marine Division. It has Mount Suribachi in the background. It has a giant flagpole with the stars and stripes flying. But in between all of that are rows and rows and rows of white crosses, that temporary cemetery on Iwo Jima. When you look at that picture, what does that mean to you? What does it represent or signify?
They made the ultimate sacrifice. And we all knew at the time it could be us. But you don't think it's you.
And we were talking about the Marine Corps Memorial in Washington, and you've been there. You've been on an honor flight, which I'd love to hear about, too, if you have some memories of that. But on that monument, it has a quote from Admiral Nimitz that says a lot in just a few words. It says, "Among the Marines in the Pacific War, uncommon valor was a common virtue." What does that mean to you?
Well, it means they appreciated what we were doing as a unit. It's not an individual thing.
And it sounds like you're saying the guys in this photo here, as a snapshot, as a cross-section of that, that they lived up to those words.
Absolutely. I don't know of anybody, I've never heard anybody apologize for being there. They were glad to be a part of it. That's what they went in the Marine Corps for.
and their sacrifice helped accelerate an Allied victory in World War II that we are still benefiting from 80 years after the Battle of Iwo Jima. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com if you'd like to access the complete original interviews with each of the Purple Heart Marines you heard from today, not to mention the dozens of other veterans we've met who spent a little time on Iwo Jima. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.